Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
I'm Brian Cox.
There's a new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage, and we are dealing with things like the history of astronomy and the changing ideas of the night sky.
Spiders.
Well, spiders. You did not like spiders, did you? We're also going to be looking at the nature of the material your face is made of, which, of course, is not known anywhere else on the planet Earth. It is totally inhuman. And we're going to be telling you how to commit the perfect murder.
The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts. My wife is a big fan of yours, by the way.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 18th of February, these are our main stories. More than 50 people are reported to have been killed in Syria in an attack by Islamic State militants. Pakistani police said they've regained control of their headquarters in Karachi from militants who stormed the building. Five former US police officers have pleaded not guilty to murdering the young black man Tyree Nichols last month. Also in this podcast,
so many of the artists that we work with that came out of graffiti, came out of street, have gone on to become incredible artists in the studio.
The largest exhibition ever dedicated to street art in the UK opens its doors in London. State media in Syria say 53 people have been killed by suspected Islamic State fighters. They were collecting truffles when they came under attack. Our Middle East regional editor Mike Thompson told me more.
What we know is that all this happened in the central desert area of Syria, and the people involved were all picking truffles, agricultural farmers out there picking truffles, and that's when they were attacked. 53 people are thought to have died. It's thought dozens have been kidnapped as well. Some, though, happily did manage to escape.
And the significance of truffle picking is that people are very vulnerable when they're doing
it. Indeed, that's right. And it's not the first time this has happened, because these suspected Islamic State jihadists know that people have no protection when they're out in the fields, but of course they need to get food on the table, so they go. And it was only, in fact, on Saturday that 16 people died in a very similar attack in the same area.
This has been blamed on Islamic State in Syria, a group that doesn't hold any territory in Syria, but clearly is still active.
Well, exactly, because Islamic State lost its last piece of territory back in March 2019, but it's thought there are numerous sleeper cells operating in that region, and indeed further north and east as well.
And is there any expectation that Islamic State in Syria are on the rise at the moment?
Well, they have been renewing. There's been more attacks, despite the fact that there's been quite a military clampdown on the group. One of the things they've been doing is not just attacking these poor people in their fields, they've also been trying to release their own members who are held in detention camps. And there are something like 10,000 Islamic State or suspected Islamic State people being held at the moment in detention centres in the region.
And just one other development today to ask you about, Mike. US and Kurdish soldiers have said they've killed a senior Islamic State leader in northeast Syria. What do we know about that?
Well, that was a helicopter raid in northern Syria, and the target was this Islamic State leader you mentioned, Hamza al-Homsi. He was killed at the cost of four US soldiers being injured. The raid was a combined US and Kurdish one.
Our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson. The authorities in the Pakistani city of Karachi say they've retaken control of the police headquarters hours after it was stormed by militants. The assault on Friday began with a grenade attack, followed by a series of blasts and a fierce gun battle. Pakistani officials say all three militants were killed. Three police officers and a civilian also died, and more than a dozen people were injured. Some reports say the attackers are wearing police uniforms. Celia Hatton spoke to a local journalist, Hunain Amin, who was at the scene of the attack until police cleared the area.
Since this attack started unfolding, I was reporting from atop a pedestrian bridge that was right across the scene of crime. I saw at least two explosions there. Apparently, it was a five-story building, and terrorists were on the top floors, like on the roof and on the fifth floor. So the two explosions that I heard were apparently, one of them was a person, an alleged terrorist, detonating himself because they were wearing suicide jackets, according to the security information that we have gathered.
And Hunain, tell me more about the location where this police quarters is located in Karachi. It's quite a sensitive location.
There are so many heavy sensitive installations, security installations there. There are so many offices there which are sensitive in, you know, all sense of the ways. It is close to the hotel where PSL players, you know, are staying.
Hunain Amin. To Memphis, Tennessee now, where five former police officers have pleaded not guilty to murdering Tyree Nichols. He was a young black man who died last month after police kicked and punched him in a traffic stop close to his home. A video of the incident sparked widespread anger across the country with calls for police reform. Outside court, Tyree Nichols' mother, Rovaughn Wells, gave this emotional statement.
I know my son is gone. I know I'll never see him again. We have to start this process of justice right now. And I want each and every one of those police officers to be able to look me in the face. They haven't done that yet. They couldn't even do that today. They're going to see me at every court date, everyone, until we get justice for my son.
I spoke to our correspondent, Barbara Platt-Usher, and asked her what happened in court.
It was quite a short hearing. The five former police officers were all present together with their lawyers. We were not really able to see the expressions on their faces because they were all wearing masks, medical masks that we have been using for COVID. So it was their lawyers who put forward their pleas. All of them pleaded not guilty. The judge then said that the next hearing would be on May 1st. He urged everyone to be patient and to be civil. He said that this could take a fair bit of time, this case, and also he recognized that emotions were high, but he said that everyone had the right to a fair trial under the law, and he would not entertain any kind of behavior that jeopardized that. As you were hearing from Tyree Nichols' mother, she was actually present in the court at the time and has said that she plans to be present at every session going forward.
Very powerful hearing her say, the officers didn't have the courage to look me in the face. Give me a little bit more on the impact this case is having and the debate about American police brutality.
It was a particularly troubling video, and having seen a number of these videos, as many Americans have in the past, about times when the police officers appear to have used excessive force, this one was pretty brutal and caused a lot of outrage. So there is a strong movement again, or it has been revived, I should say, to talk about how to reduce excessive force used by police, how to bring in police reforms. And so this case, I think, is going to be followed very closely, not only in terms of accountability for the death of Tyree Nichols, but also to see whether it triggers any further action on that score. You remember, of course, the racial justice protests after the killing of George Floyd and the move to have legislation that would bring in police reforms. That's stalled in the Senate right now, but there are other steps also that the family is asking for. So I think those will proceed in parallel with the case.
Barbara Platt-Usher with me from Washington. President Zelensky has appealed directly to Western leaders to speed up their delivery of weapons to Ukraine. He told a security conference in Munich that any delay would cost lives. But while President Macron of France said the West should intensify its support for Ukraine, Chancellor Scholz of Germany warned against hasty decisions. From Munich, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale.
It's almost 1 year since Russian tanks rolled over Ukraine's borders, but President Zelensky's pleas for help have become no less urgent. Speaking by video link, he told world leaders in Munich that Ukraine was locked into a David and Goliath battle with Russia. And David, he said, defeated Goliath not with conversation, but action. He needed more arms and more tanks, he said, and he needed them quickly.
There is no alternative to speed, because it is the speed that the life depends on. Delay has always been and still is a mistake.
President Macron of France appeared to heed his call, saying now was not the time for dialogue with Moscow. Instead, he told the conference the West needed to intensify its support so that Ukraine would be able to launch a counteroffensive against Russian forces. Russia, he said, must not and cannot win this war. Chancellor Scholz of Germany, too, urged NATO allies to send Ukraine the battle tanks they had promised after it emerged that some countries were struggling to deliver as many as hoped. But Mr. Scholz once again warned against rushing to supply Ukraine with new weapons.
Die Balance zwischen bestmöglicher Unterstützung der Ukraine.
We'll continue to strike a balance between providing the best possible support for Ukraine and avoiding any unintended escalation. Caution must take priority over hasty decisions, and unity over going it alone.
That caution is a source of frustration in Kyiv, which sees Russian forces beginning to intensify their attacks in the east, probing for weaknesses in Ukraine's front lines ahead of a much-signaled offensive. But will Western tanks arrive in time? Will stocks of shells and ammunition last? Western ministers here in Munich insist they will. Many lives depend on them being right.
Now, as we heard in the earlier podcast, a spy who worked at the British Embassy in Berlin and sold secrets to Russia has been jailed for 13 years. David Smith, who's 58, passed on the details of other members of staff, as well as pictures and videos of the building itself, while working as a security guard. A court in London heard he was caught in a sting operation involving two fake Russian agents who were in reality working for the British security services. Here's Tom Simons.
David Smith worked in the security control room of the embassy. He could see who came in and who went out. He could wander freely around the building. In 2020, police obtained a letter he sent to a Russian general passing on the names, addresses and phone numbers of colleagues, along with documents and information about security. A joint investigation began involving MI5 and German police, which ended today with a 13-year prison sentence and condemnation from the judge, Mr. Justice Wall.
You were paid by Russia for your treachery. It was your job to ensure that the embassy was secure and its staff safe. When you did what you did, it was the most obvious breach of the trust placed in you.
As part of the investigation, Smith was told a Russian, Dmitry, was coming for a meeting at the embassy. Smith appeared to believe this was a walk-in, someone selling Russian secrets to the UK. He was captured on a covert camera, taking pictures of Dmitry from the embassy's CCTV screens and muttering that the Russians might recognise the visitor. Smith appeared equally keen to help when another Russian, Irina, equipped with a hidden camera, bumped into him in the street and asked about identifying possible defectors. Both Irina and Dmitry worked for MI5 to entrap the security guard. Metropolitan Police Commander Richard Smith said there was no doubt about his motivations.
Smith was motivated by anti-UK, pro-Russian views. He understood that the information he was collecting was damaging to British interests, probably understood that he was likely to put people at risk of harm, and yet he shared it with the Russians anyway.
As a security guard, Smith had no access to military secrets, but he's believed to have given the Russians videos of the inside of the embassy and other low-level documents. The risk that the names and addresses of staff might have been compromised meant a full safety assessment was required, costing more than £800,000. But the full extent of the material he shared may never be known.
Now, if you think of the cities that are hotbeds of innovative technology, Helsinki may not be near the top of your list, but as the home of some of the most ambitious and successful games makers in the world, the Finnish capital is considered by many to be the epicentre of mobile gaming. Our gaming correspondent Stefan Powell has been to Helsinki and told me more.
It's interesting. It's sort of lots of reasons, right? But I suppose to put it into context, you know, the first Angry Bird, we've probably all played, or many people have played or watched or seen somebody playing Angry Bird. The first ever Angry Bird was flicked across the screen of an iPad in Helsinki. Netflix has got into gaming recently. They set up their first ever internal gaming studios in Helsinki, saying it had the best games talent in the world. And a lot of this is for complex reasons, but it largely dates back to the 90s, well, the 80s and the 90s. Finland wasn't an especially wealthy country at the time, and so the technology people had at home wasn't necessarily the best. And that led to programmers and developers there at the time pushing the envelope with the tech that they did have. There was a growth of a scene called the demo scene, where they would make art presentations, music, games, pushing the envelope. And you had that set up, and then Nokia turned up and started making mobile games. And they realised there, well, hang about, we don't need any big games publishers because there weren't any there. We don't need any big game studios. There weren't any there because we've got this handset manufacturer and these people that were used to doing a lot with a very little.
This is true in all sorts of sectors all over the world, where when it starts somewhere, everyone who's interested in the cutting edge of gaming wants to go there and collaborate with other people who are into it. And it's interesting that that's still happening, even in such a high-tech business post-pandemic. We've all got used to working remotely all over the place, and yet everyone's still going to Finland.
And they're choosing to move there. That's the interesting thing. And there are a couple of reasons why people are doing that. 30% of the games industry in Finland are developers that have moved to live and work there, which is about right. But you're in a northern European city, which isn't perhaps known for its climate, to draw people in. And they do that for a couple of ways. Firstly, there's a lot of government intervention in the sense that the developers I was speaking to out there saying we are allowed to fail. In other words, we can get grants from the government for proof of concept. If it doesn't work out, doesn't matter. We know that we're comfortable with our social security setup here. If everything goes wrong, I haven't had to remortgage my house to set up a business. The government are having to do that, having to be interventionist, because they know that is a way to attract people to set up companies. And the more companies set up, the more they'd go big.
And the Finnish government is keen, presumably, for Helsinki to stay on top, for it to maintain this position.
Exactly that. And so to stay on top, you need people to come and set up businesses there. You want developers to move. So they go out and they actively recruit developers from all over the world. And what's interesting is I was assuming going out there that the reason that a lot of people would want to move is perhaps there were tax incentives, or perhaps there were higher salaries or whatever. There are no major tax incentives. The salaries aren't higher than they are in Silicon Valley. But what they offer is what they call the soft sell. In other words, school system is very good there and is ranked one of the best in the world. It was ranked recently the happiest country in the world. Work finishes at 4:30 and that's it. You work hard in the day, but you're not getting emails at 11 o'clock at night, especially post-pandemic. They say we have a nice life here, and that it's that work-life balance that they use to sell this dream to people that have allowed them to move, and it's led to this reputation.
Our gaming correspondent Stefan Powell. And still to come,
optimism for me is the way people think about bad events and good events in their lives.
So are you an optimist or a pessimist? Next to France, three members of a far-right group have been found guilty of plotting to attack the French President Emmanuel Macron. They'd planned to attack him with a knife at a First World War commemoration ceremony in 2018. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
This trial centred on the point at which words and claimed intentions become a genuine criminal plot. There was no question that the 13 people on trial harboured hatred towards the president and towards migrants. In their online chats, they spoke of extravagant plans to blow up mosques. All the time, they were being tracked by the intelligence services. And when four men did set out, apparently with a plan to assassinate the president, they were immediately arrested. Those four were convicted because the court found the link existed between words and action. For the rest, it was just talk.
The United Nations has announced it's cutting the amount of food aid it gives to Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. Nearly 750,000 of the mostly Muslim minority fled there 5 years ago from Myanmar to escape army attacks. And along with many of those who arrived earlier, almost 1 million Rohingya people are still in temporary shacks and fed by the World Food Programme. From next month, they'll get $10 per person per month, $2 less. Paul Henley's been talking to John Aliaf, Director for the Asia and Pacific region of the World Food Programme. So how significant is this cut?
This ration cut is very serious because the WFP ration is their only viable means of sustenance. It's illegal for these refugees to work in Bangladesh. They're also fenced in the camps with very little freedom of movement. So even venturing outside of these camps in the pursuit of employment is an immensely risky thing for them. They actually have very few options at their disposal. The cut in the World Food Programme's ration in the camps just simply means that they will eat less.
Is that a threat to life in some cases?
Very much so. We're very concerned by what will happen when this population goes hungry. Already 40% of the children under five in these camps are chronically malnourished. Anemia is very high. And already 12% of the kids have faced acute malnutrition. That's today, before the ration cut.
But there are other risks that people in those camps could face with the withdrawal of funding, aren't there?
Indeed. Rising hunger may provoke the refugees to make desperate decisions, and that's what we're also very concerned about at the World Food Programme. People will be more tempted to engage in risky pursuits, entering crime. Some of the refugees already are in desperation, looking to drug trafficking as a means to raise income. And beyond that, of course, we've got the threat of migration. The refugees tell us even today that human traffickers have increased their activities in the camps in the last 12 to 18 months. These traffickers promise a better life elsewhere in exchange for money, put them on boats on the high seas, sending them to other countries. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees already reports that in 2022, 5 times more refugees from the Rohingya population risked their lives on the high seas on these boats. The boats are precarious, and so it's a really desperate and risky move.
And looking at the bigger picture, why does the World Food Programme have less money now?
Rohingya refugees, when they came over from Myanmar following some quite horrendous human rights abuses in 2017, it was 1 million refugees. That is an expensive undertaking for the international community. And yet that international community has provided funding up to now and really stood by these refugees, helped Bangladesh to host them. But inevitably, as we know, 2023 is a year of unprecedented humanitarian need. Crises around the world have escalated in their magnitude and intensity. And of course, the increase in prices of fuel, food and fertilizer have made it not only more difficult for the populations that we're serving around the world, but also for donor governments to provide aid budgets at the same level. Donors are stretching, but the needs are just too high and there just isn't enough money to go around.
John Alia from the World Food Programme. Now football. A leading Qatari banker has confirmed a bid by the English Premier League club Manchester United. Sheikh Jassim bin Hamad Al Thani will lead a consortium that wants to buy the club outright. The Qatari bid came shortly before a deadline for submitting offers. The British businessman and lifelong fan Jim Ratcliffe has already put in a rival bid. The club is currently owned by the American Glazer family, which says it's exploring strategic alternatives. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss reports from outside Old Trafford in Manchester.
We've had a bid from Sheikh Jassim bin Hamad Al Thani. He's the chairman of a Qatari bank. He's the son of a former prime minister of Qatar, and he says he is a lifelong Manchester United fan. In a statement, he says his bid will return the club to its former glories, both on and off the pitch. He says his bid is for 100% of the club and will be completely debt-free through his foundation. Remember, the current owners, the Glazer family, angered a lot of the fans here by plunging the club into millions of pounds of debt, and he says his vision is for Manchester United to be regarded as the greatest football club in the world, although he doesn't give any size or amount of his bid. Now, one potential stumbling block is that a Qatari consortium already owns another major European club in Paris Saint-Germain, but we understand that this court consortium regards itself as entirely separate, so they don't believe there would be any conflict of interest. Now, Qatar, of course, has just hosted the World Cup, although many fans here will be concerned about the country's human rights record. We are expecting other bids to emerge. The British billionaire Sir Jim Ratcliffe has already expressed an interest, and it is still the early stages. This is a significant move.
The largest exhibition ever dedicated to street art in the UK has opened its doors at the Saatchi Gallery in London. It's called Beyond the Streets, and Sara Minetta has been to have a look.
Walking in the Saatchi Gallery these days is like stepping back in time to the 80s. The wall at the entrance covered by graffiti, on the right a reconstruction of a record store, with crates stacked with vinyl records, posters, stickers and skateboards plastering the walls.
It really sets the scene for what you're about to see and how that helped inspire multiple cities around the world.
This is Roger Gastman, the curator of the show.
We're not reclaiming pieces from the street and showing them. 85% of the work that's in this show was made for this show. So many of the artists that we work with that came out of graffiti, came out of street, have gone on to become incredible artists in the studio.
With its bright colors and contrasts, its bent letters and irreverent content, street art has often been a means of protest, rebellion, and political messages.
Street art is a courageous act of defiance. It's bending or breaking the rules, saying that there should be room for expression in public space.
This is Shepard Fairey. His posters of President Obama and the Women's March have become iconic.
Street art is naturally democratizing things. People are participating, whether they have permission or not, who aren't just the rich and powerful. So I think especially right now, those voices of the people need to be heard.
But for decades, street art wasn't considered art at all. Photographer Esteban Oriol, who immortalized gangs in Los Angeles, knows this very well.
You know, back in the day, most of the stuff that's here would have been illegal or we'd be considered vandals, and now we're considered artists.
Graffiti is still illegal in the UK and in the US. It can be punished with fines and even jail time. That's part of the reason why this exhibit is so groundbreaking.
I know many of my friends who've gone to jail because of this kind of stuff.
This is Ozzy Juarez, the youngest artist on exhibition here.
I grew up in an area where people like me don't make it anywhere. People like me end up dying, going to jail.
Why did you start doing graffitis?
You don't have access to a lot of materials. You don't have access to art. Also, it's not very encouraging from other people like teachers or your own family to become an artist, you know? So there's always that kind of rebellion.
Ozzy's paintings represent portals to other dimensions. White, shiny lights on a magnetic blue canvas. They combine the lines and the brilliant colors of graffiti with the balance and the harmony of a classical piece for a whole new end result. If you ask him, this is what the future of art looks like.
Sara Mendetta reporting on street art. In recent months, we've heard about many difficult issues on the Global News podcast. Earthquakes, war, rising energy bills, recessions, the list goes on. With all this going on, does it help to be an optimist in life? The man who's thought more about this than perhaps anyone is the American psychologist Martin Seligman. He's director of the Applied Positive Psychology Program at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of many books on the subject, like Learned Optimism and Authentic Happiness. Evan Davis has been talking to him and asked how we remain optimistic or even happy.
Optimism for me is the way people think about bad events and good events in their lives. So pessimists, when a bad event occurs, believe it is permanent, it's pervasive, and there's nothing they can do about it. Optimists, on the other hand, when bad events occur, believe it's temporary, it's just this one situation, and they can do things about it. And indeed, this dimension, optimism and pessimism, has all sorts of positive and negative effects in life.
You're better off being optimist because you don't go into everything with a weary resignation. Is that right? So you make more effort. You're more motivated to act, to get out of bed in the morning, really.
Well, the key variable is trying. Pessimists give up. They stop trying. Now, that's adaptive in a world which trying does no good. But in our world, in which it often pays off to trying, optimists do better. Okay. And they do better in the three realms of life. They resist depression. They're more productive at work. And they live longer than pessimists.
That's interesting that they actually live longer. That's proven, is it, that the optimist outlook gives you a better heart?
There are about 20 large-scale studies involving hundreds of thousands of people now, in which you take optimists and pessimists at time one. For example, at age 65, you wait 10 years and you ask the question, who lives and who dies? And so it's widely found that pessimistic people, the bottom quartile of pessimists, die at between 6 and 8 years earlier than optimists on average. Being in the bottom quartile of pessimists is a risk factor for cardiovascular death, about equivalent to smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
Extraordinary. All the things you view in the world, Martin, the news, the war in Ukraine, energy prices, inflation, political instability, there isn't much most of us can do about it. So are we destined to be pessimists when it comes to those kinds of events?
Well, first of all, there have always been bad events in the world. And even though the UK may seem gloomy to you these days, it's important to know that in the last 200 years, the rate of child mortality has gone from 44% to 0.1%, that the average income has increased hugely in the last 200 years, and that life expectancy has doubled in the last century. So in the long run, we always confront bad events. It's a part of being a human being. But the way we look at those bad events is crucial to our future. If we look at them in the gloomy, most pessimistic way, we give up. We don't try. It's self-fulfilling. We don't do as well at work. We get depressed more easily. And our life has more morbidity and earlier mortality.
The question, how does one make oneself a more optimistic person in this very specific way that you're talking about? It's not just always look on the bright side of life, is it? It's something more about feeling like you have some agency and things can get better.
The crucial move, Evan, is first to recognize the most catastrophic things you say to yourself and then to dispute them realistically. So, for example, when this call started, I said to myself, "Jim, I'm 80 years old. Can I still do good BBC interviews?" And then when we started to talk, I argued against this catastrophic interpretation. I said, "No, it's going well. I've given the right example. And Evan is asking the right questions." If you're rejected by someone you love, for example, you can make the most catastrophic interpretation, "I'm unlovable," or you can treat the voices that tell you you're a reject, you're unlovable, as if they were a third person whose mission in life was to make you miserable, and then to argue realistically against it, to go over the evidence in your life that you found love, that it worked for a while, and that the reason this breakup occurred is not because you're unlovable, but because that guy is a
Are you living proof of this, Martin? Are you optimistic, and have you engaged in some of this kind of therapy for yourself?
Yes, I take my own medicine, Evan. So I'm a born pessimist and a born depressive. And what I've had to do over my life is first recognize that and then invent and use the various techniques we've developed in cognitive psychology and in positive psychotherapy to overcome it. So indeed, I'm a measurer. And what's happened across my life is I've gone from pessimist to optimist and from a depressive to someone who knows how to dispute the most pessimistic thoughts that occur to me. The voices never go away that tell you you're a loser, you're not doing well, you're a reject. But what you learn to do, and what I've learned to do, is to argue rationally against those voices.
The optimistic American psychologist Martin Seligman. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or we're on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randell. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
"I keep thinking so much about you."
"She's so stunning."
"It's all well planned."
Love, Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
"She was trying to get me to send her money."
And it's available now.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
Search for Love, Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, actor Asif Manvi.
"Indian people did not go to the theater to see themselves."
Asif shares the story of writing the one-person play, Sakina's Restaurant.
"What do you mean there's a play about me and my experience?"
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.